Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
All right, welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm your host, Al Warren, and joining me today is Cab Thompson.
Hey, Al, what's going on?
Well, I'm going to go buy some Nikes.
yeah, that's what I hear.
Yeah.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, I am. Well,
I just bought two pair myself.
Yeah, there you go. See, there's Ron there. See, we're, hey, you know, but I'll tell you one thing. I certainly wouldn't burn my Nikes. You know how much they cost?
I know.
Is that crazy?
Oh, yeah. Like, well, you can have mine before I burn them.
Oh. What a waste. I tell you, it's a waste. If you want to hear more about that, you know, our show yesterday with Joe talks about that a lot on the conspiracy angle, which is quite interesting about the outrage everybody feels. It's like every day, everyone's looking for an outrage.
Oh, well, this one's easy. I mean, you know, a guy that sat on the bench gets in a major endorsement for not playing.
I'm all for it. I'm glad Nike took the initiative. It's not often that I'm supporting of big companies, but I'm glad they actually did something refreshing, you know, rather than just what they normally do, which is nothing. So,
they did promote him from a quarterback to a fullback. I want the full amount that I paid him back.
Yeah. That's bad Republican jokes. And okay, so everything's been going smooth. And what can I say? It's smoky again here. We cannot breathe in Seattle. More of the fires continue. And I think it's the Republicans setting them.
Well, it's probably all the Nikes burning up there.
No, they don't do that here. This is a liberal city. Not like Alabama. Come on. Okay, now, speaking of crime, and that means we're not going to talk about Trump, but we're going to talk about other...
Remember, those were your words.
Well, you know, crime is crime. Hey, you know, I forgot also, I love the hearings going on with the for the Supreme Court judge nomination.
I can say is wow.
To protest is to be American. And that's what it is to be an American. It's protest. It's the ability to speak your mind.
I will agree. I will partially agree. But
it's the ability to speak your mind. As long as you're not shooting someone or hurting someone like that, you can stand up and our guests are Ron Chepsik and we've got Mike Rowe. So, hey, guys, do you agree or not?
you said a lot to agree about what?
Well, you're right to protest.
Kaepernick is all American. Yes, indeed, he is. And I think it's very ballsy of Nike to do this ad campaign. It's really surprising, you know, for an American company to stick their neck out like that.
Yeah.
But I think they know what they're doing.
Yeah. Oh,
but
for sure.
The guy we're going to talk about today, Teddy Rowe, was sort of the Colin Kaepernick of Chicago.
Oh,
if you're exactly. He wasn't very popular with a lot of white people.
Oh, that's
right, Mike.
That's the way we like it. Well, you guys wrote this book. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Now it is on Kindle, and
right.
It's called Robin Hood of the Hood, and it's the life and times of Teddy Rowe, Policy King. So tell me, first of all, before we get into the book details. How did you guys meet and get to write this book?
Mike tells it well. Oh. I'll let Mike take the lead on this. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, sure thing. Okay, well, what happened was, you know, I had been researching a long time, and I came across one of Ron's books. I saw people referencing his book, you know, Black Gangsters of Chicago. And when I first saw the book, I was like, you know, what does this guy know? He's not from Chicago, a white guy. What do you know about, you know, Black Gangsters of Chicago? So I kind of, you know, I didn't bother about a book. But as I, you know, continued researching, I kept seeing people reference him. I said, well, you know, maybe I better check it out. So I got the book, you know, wasn't really expecting much. Then when I got the book, you know, I couldn't put it down. I read it in all in one sitting, and that prompted me to buy several of his other titles. Gangsters of Harlem, the Frank Matthews stories, and a few others. And I finally just said, you know what? And I was just so impressed by the writing, the information that it contained. I mean, I thought that I knew a lot, but I found out so much more that I didn't know by reading his book. So I did research and, you know, got a contact number to his company, and I had just called him up one day. He was nice enough to take my call. And I said, first, I'd just like to thank you for writing these books, keeping these stories that I've steadily told, keeping them alive, and I asked him for some research tips. And as we dialogued, you know, he said, well, why don't we write a book about Teddy Rowe? We can collaborate, because I've been telling him about the research that I've been doing about policy and numbers and stuff like that. So I was kind of like, yeah, sure. And, you know, I didn't take it seriously, because I was like, well, I've never written anything outside of college term papers. And I'm like, this guy's an accomplished writer. So he probably didn't really want to write anything with me. And he called me back about 2 weeks later and asked me how it was going. I'm like, wow, this guy's serious about, you know, writing it. So I started, you know, getting my research together. And I was saying what I did to him. And Ron was so patient and understanding that he knew I wasn't a writer. So he gave me a lot of tips about saying, you know, when you're writing like an academic, you know, let me tell you how to write about, you know, how to write for the general public. And so back and forth, I was sending what I had. He would send me what I had. He would critique, you know, give me, you know, advice about improving my writing. And about a year later, we had the book. And I know it was funny. You know, when I first called him, I told him my name was Michael Rowe. He kind of thought I was a descendant of Ted Rowe. So I was like, you know, that was kind of like a funny thing between us. Now, I joke about that I am related to him, but, before, you know, I'm really not. But, you know, and I also said that the grand jury investigated me for policy. You know, I'm joking about that. But
yeah,
I've hired Mike as my publicity guy since then.
Yeah.
He's handling all my publicity. That.
Well, there you go. That's good. Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah. He said Mike Rowe. I mean, what are the odds of somebody interested in writing a book about Ted Rowe with the same name, you know?
I was going to say.
Also, you got your own TV show, or you used to, Dirty Jobs.
Yeah, that was my former show, yeah, before I started writing.
Well, there you go. A very, very busy person. Now, yeah, and Ron is a really, I'm trying to get a good word here, but you're a good writer, but there's a very, there's a certain word you can do. You're very detailed about your writing. You're very, into
meticulous.
Getting, yeah, and you want to get the right facts and everything. So, how long did it take you to put this together?
Well, it took us a little while. You know, it's a short book. It's an e-book. You know, we're trying to take advantage of the market, you know, for this type of books. You know, people have very short attention spans today.
Oh, yeah.
And so, if you look on Amazon, there's these, what they call Kindle shorts, you know, the various times, like 30 to 60 pages, you know, that's 30 or 60 minutes or whatever. And so, but, you know, like Mike said, he was inexperienced as a writer, and I was curious to see what, you know, what he could do. And we were in no rush, you know, to get it out because it wasn't like a major project. You know, it wasn't going to, you know, change either our careers or anything like that, make us a lot of money and all that. So it took us, you know, a little while to do that, and sending back and forth. But you know, the patience paid off because Mike developed, and I saw him develop as a writer. And I used to be a writing instructor. I taught freelance journalism in UCLA's Extension Division, and I taught a lot of freelance courses. So I enjoyed teaching, and I haven't done that for like maybe 10 years or so. So it was kind of nice to watch Mike develop on that, and I'm trying to encourage him to continue on. You know, he was talking about starting a blog on Black history, especially in Chicago, and I think there'd be an interest in that. And he's really knowledgeable. He's very, very knowledgeable on policy, as you'll see when we talk about what policy was or numbers, what the numbers racket was on that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and that's important. You know, a lot of people want to find out, and I that's good. You know, Mike, keep on going. Don't let anybody discourage you. Just keep moving forward. And do what you know is right, and do it well.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and just keep going. Now, let's talk about Teddy Rowe. Who wants to tell me who Teddy Rowe was exactly?
Well, I could start off a little bit, and Mike could pick up. Very interesting mm-hmm. guy, born at the turn of the 20th century, and in Louisiana, rural Louisiana. You know, which was very segregated at the time, and he moved to Arkansas, and eventually moved to Detroit looking for work, and which was very common at the time. There was a lot of African Americans from the South moving north. You know, there were several migrations that took place, constantly looking for work, and depending on what part of the country they were from, either settled, you know, in one of the big cities like Detroit, New York, or Chicago, and a lot of people from Louisiana and Mississippi, Alabama, and that area ended up in Chicago. So he eventually went there, and he developed a craft, a tailor. He became a tailor, and when he eventually arrived in Chicago in search of employment, he ended up with interesting character named Ed Jones, who was one of the most important historical figures in early 20th century Chicago African American history. And Mike, you want to pick up from there?
Yeah, and I guess I'll pick up. Hello.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'll pick up here. And like I said, Ted Rowe, you know, say after he went to work for Ed Jones. You know, Jones had went from the tailor business, you know, into the numbers business, and pretty much became the biggest policy or numbers operator on the south side of Chicago, and then Rowe became his tenant. And as the, you know, and during this time, it was pretty much strictly an African-American operation. So this was before the outfit or the mafia had heard about the operation or really knew much about it. They had often heard of it, but no one, you know, really took it seriously. Some people called it nigger pool. I remember one of the mayors of Chicago said, you know, my police force has better things to do than try to break up some crap game. Cause no one really thought, you know, African Americans could put anything that was really worthwhile together. So it was kind of really relatively ignored. you know, outside of the African American community. But as, you know, as the prohibition era ended, which was the main money maker for the mafia, they looked for, you know, other ventures. And, you know, Ed Jones again, and he was locked up in Terre Indiana federal prison the same time as Sam Giancana was. And for whatever reason, the two of them, I guess, became acquaintances. I wouldn't say friends. And he told Giancana, you know, and his people speculate why he did this. Some say he wanted to spread policy outside of the African-American community. But he told Sam Giancana everything about the numbers business, and they agreed to kind of work together. But this was to Ed Jones' downfall. I wouldn't jump too far ahead of myself.
Right, on that. And Sam Giancana, we know who Sam Giancana is. He eventually became, you know, godfather of the outfit, and he was implicated in, you know, assassination of JFK and all that. And he was just, he wasn't really a major player at this time in the late 1930s, early 1940s when he met up with Ed Roe. But he was very ambitious, and he was a nasty individual, very nasty, but very shrewd. You know, a lot of people questioned his intelligence, you know, whether he was smart or not. But I think he has the cunning to be a really top-notch criminal, and he eventually, you know, proved that to be. And as far as Ed Jones, I think he tried to, you know, he saw this white guy that had a little bit of power being associated with the mafia, and I think he tried to ingratiate himself with him, you know, and that's why he was so talkative. But man, did he talk! You know, he blabbed everything, and it was like an education for Giancana. He sat in this prison listening to this, and he couldn't really believe it. He never really believed it, you know. He wanted to believe it because he saw an opportunity for himself as a gangster to move up in the outfit, this new stream of money and all that. And he didn't really believe it until he got out of prison, and Ed Jones got out of prison, and he was able to see how Ed Jones lived. I mean, Ed Jones lived like a king. And maybe Mike can talk about, you know, his lavish lifestyle on Ed Jones led.
Right. I said, Ed Jones, you know, he had not only top real estate in Chicago, he owned a big Benjamin Franklin store, he had property in Mexico, you know, he was known as the man who never wore the same suit never wore the same suit twice. He had like 1,000 people working for him. And he and Colin Brothers talked about this in his book. He was saying how Giancana was so impressed by Ed Jones. He said, I just never knew the shine, well, you know, the slang, a derogatory term from African Americans. He said, I never knew the shine where this model can put something like this together. And, you know, they were making thousands and thousands of dollars a day, you know, off the operation that people just use nickel, dimes, and pennies to play often. So, like, Ed Jones, like I said, he was like the real, you know, like how you would look at a mafia movie and see a godfather. That's how Ed Jones lived, like a real godfather or a king, hence the term policy king.
Right. Mike, maybe you should talk a little bit about what we mean by policy, because there's a lot of confusion between numbers and...
Definitely.
You do such a great job. Numbers. Right, you do such a good job in breaking it down like that. Why don't you go ahead and explain?
Oh, sure thing. I'd be happy to. Okay, well, you often hear two terms, policy, and you often hear the term numbers. Now, oftentimes, initially there were two separate things. Policy was played more so in the West, like the North, you know, the Midwest, like Chicago, Indiana, places like that, and it was played, you know, similar to the way the state lottery is. You could play, but back then you could play for as little as a penny, or as much as to, or however much you wanted to play. And the number was drawn out of a wheel, you know. They would draw 10 numbers, and you had to, you know, you would try to win 3 of them. Now, numbers was played mostly on the East Coast, like in New York and places like that. And the way they got their winning number, they used the last 3 digits of the clearinghouse stock exchange totals. And over time, as people migrated, you know, people from Chicago would go out, establish, you know, business in different areas of the state. People from New York would come out where, you know, like to Chicago. The games eventually became synonymous with one another, where you can go to a policy station and play policy, or you can play numbers. And then the terms just kind of became interchangeable. Like if you watch the old movie, you would hear people within the same sentence, you know, numbers runner or policy wheel. They became interchangeable, but initially there were two separate games. And Caspar Holstein is credited with, he was a migrant from the Caribbean. He's credited with starting numbers, and policy Sam Young from New Orleans is credited with Stylus and policy in about 1885 in Chicago.
Right. It's really interesting. You mentioned Caspar Holstein, which I wrote about in my book, Gangsters of Harlem. He, like Mike said, he was from the Caribbean. But he was an example of how important policy was to the African American community in times of segregation and racism, because he was a major employer in his community. And that's what people don't understand, is that policy had a tremendous beneficial impact on the African American community by creating business and hiring people. And because, you know, they needed number runners, they needed people to operate the policy wheels. They needed,
right, you needed people to collect the numbers, you needed people to keep account of the money. So it was like pretty much any well-established, think of Bank of America or, you know, any major bank and how many employees they had. That's pretty similar to how a policy station would, you know, and it was different, you know, there were like there were 12 major policy operators in Chicago at the time, and they all had their own policy station, so just imagine how many people that kept employed.
Right.
At this point in the story, though,
what was their relationship with local law enforcement?
Okay, very interesting question. Okay, now, you got to, it was similar to how, I mean, policy was generally viewed as a harmless vice by most people, you know, because, like, everybody played it. It was played out, and it was like an open secret. You can go anywhere, the barber shop, the grocery store. You can see advertisements for, you know, each policy drawing, because they have a daily morning drawing, they have a midday drawing, the evening drawing. Like I said, similar to the way Lowry is today. And it was just really open. You had people who were, when I talked to people who lived in the era, they lament about how the policy man would come to the house and, you know, collect everybody's numbers. So it was an open secret. I mean, law enforcement did crack down at times, but some people viewed it as, you know, something bad and stuff like that. But most people didn't. And then the policy kings, they were very well politically connected. So they were often able to avoid prosecution, you know, like, you know, by paying graft or bribes. And in a city like Chicago, which is notorious, synonymous with corruption, you know, so they kind of worked hand in hand.
Right. And also, you know, they were, the policy kings were powerful individuals politically in the community. You know, they could help get out the black vote and all that, you know, when the time came, and get black support for policies that the white establishment were passing. And, of course, they paid them graft. I mean, everybody was on the take in those days, you know. In Chicago, it was a very corrupt city, and the Capone mob, you know, Capone started the outfit, was not the only group that was taking advantage of the corruption in the city too. The policy kings were doing it as well.
How much money are we talking? Like, what kind of money do you make by the policy?
Millions. It was a multi-million-dollar operation. I mean, you had wheels, and not even some of the major wheels were taking in like $10,000 a day. And it's not just in Chicago. When I would research, now I always come across the articles, police smash $7,000 a day policy wheel, you know, $10,000 a day policy wheel shut down in New York. I mean, and it's amazing, but I said, people were just playing with nickels, pennies, and dimes, but I said, that money adds up. So it was multi-million-dollar operation, like I said, not just Ed Jones, but all those big major policy operators, you know, own vast lands of real estate. I mean, they own own multiple legitimate businesses. So it was just really a money-making operation. That's why once the mob found out about it, that's why they were just so hungry to take it over.
Right, and of course it was technically illegal, so it was hard to get exact figures of how much money was being made, but all you had to do is look at how these policy kings lived. I mean, they lived like kings, as we described. And of course, Giacana, when he saw how Ed Jones lived, you know, this black guy who he thought was really nothing, you know, he really realized, you know, how much money was being made in that. And even when Jones was kidnapped, and we can talk a little bit about that, because that was, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it was a $100,000 ransom, and they paid it with no problems. And this is, you know, in the 1940s. So they had tremendous amounts of money, and he had money in Mexico. He had property in Mexico. He was a landowner in Mexico, and he went there regularly. In fact, that's where Ed Jones went after retiring from the business after he was kidnapped. He was so frightened by what happened. He checked out. He just said, "The heck with this, I'm leaving," and he went to Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like me now. Do you who kidnapped him, and what was the deal with that? Like, who was behind that?
Well, Sam Giancana was behind the kidnapping. They chipped out one evening, and they called Roe, his top lieutenant, and told him, you know, there was $250 ransom. And, you know, Roe told him it's not that much money on the south side of Chicago. No, more so the star tactic. But then he spoke with Jones, and Jones told him to pay the ransom. And I see a lot of people believe that once the outfit saw how fast they can come up with the $250,000 ransom, they knew this business is lucrative, as people say, so we got to get in on it. And then, you know, Jones, after the kidnapping, Jones was pretty much exiled, you know, so you can walk away with your life, and you can stay in Chicago and we'll kill you pretty much. So he beat it to Mexico.
And of course, that's where Teddy Roe saw an opportunity. You know, they expected the whole policy racket to fold, but Teddy Roe stepped in and said, being an ambitious, quote, businessman himself, and decided to step in, and he wasn't going anywhere, and that's where the problem started. But one thing I should point out is that, you know, unlike the outfit and organized crime in Chicago with the white mob and all that, there was really no violence involved in this business. I mean, really. I mean, you know, they had a council which operated like, you know, the famous council in New York City that Luciano set up between all the policy, and there was really no violence until the white mob got into the business after the kidnapping of Jones. Is that right, Mike?
Exactly. And, you know, Chuck Giancana, kind of another thing that Sam Giancana's brother Chuck's talk about in Double Cross. You know, he laments that, you know, a lot of times the Posse Kings would have their meetings, and, you know, the Boogie Woogie Club, you know, a club that was owned by Giancana. He said sometimes the meetings would get so heated, he had to pull his gun and, you know, escort people out, but it was never violent. He said with his brother, it was just straight out murder. You know, people didn't do what you're supposed to do, you get killed. Arguments, disagreements led to murder.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But you see, it wasn't like that with the Policy Kings. Because, see, you know, the illegal business, most of these guys were businessmen. You know what I mean? That's why some people call them gangsters, but the more correct term, they just were basically racketeers, maybe. Because they were in the policy business largely because they couldn't get, you know, real gainful employment anywhere else. You know, because you got to keep it. You know, keep in mind the context of when all this was occurring. This was, you know, during segregation, you know, even though it wasn't the South, Chicago was still a very segregated city. So you couldn't just go downtown and work for, say, a company like Merrill Lynch or whatever the major companies of that time were. So these guys, a lot of them were college educated, and they just had to take their accounting skills and stuff like that they learned in college and apply it to the policy business, because that was one of the few avenues that were open to them. So they just really weren't all about that violence and stuff like that. Like, you had 12 big policy operators, was called the Big 12 Syndicate. There was never any violence between them or, you know, trying to take over each other's wheels. They recognized that, hey, it's plenty to go around. You know, everybody just keep it to respectable business. And that's how it was until the outfit muscled in.
And the problem was that because they weren't really violent by nature, they were more businessmen than gangsters and all that, when the outfit moved in with their violent approach to doing criminal business, they were at a big disadvantage, you know, because they didn't know how to react, you know, because they weren't violent. I mean, if you ticked them off, they weren't going to try to kill you. They tried to negotiate with you. And you didn't do that with Giacana. Giacana was a cold-blooded killer that wore a business suit. So they were at a disadvantage, and this happened, the same thing in New York with Dutch Schultz, where Dutch Schultz was able to pick off the Policy Kings one by one. And the same thing happened in Chicago, is that when the mob moved in, they were able to pick them off one by one and eventually take over the business. But before they were able to attempt to take over the business, they had to deal with one man, and that was Teddy Roll, the Robin Hood of the Hood.
Yeah, like I said, Ted Rowe, no, he has been described as the baddest black man that ever hit the south side of Chicago. And so when you think about, yeah, they really keep this in context. And this was like in the late 40s, early 50s. So this was before the civil rights movement, before the black power movement or any of that type of stuff. It was also during the heyday of the mob. And when I say the mob, it's like the same sect of the mob that, you know, was rumored to have killed President Kennedy, that were rumored to have been involved in the Bay of Pigs and all that. So this one guy, who, like I said, didn't come from a gang, you know, wasn't a gangster, stand up to this type of mob during that time, it's just unheard of. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just unbelievable that he had this type of guts to do something like that.
Right, and that was part of his, you know, the expression where somebody acts really crazy and everybody's afraid of him because they don't know what he's going to do. And they didn't know what to do with Teddy Roll, because, you know, Teddy Roll even had a confrontation with Sam Giacana, where Sam Giacana was in a nightclub called the Boogie Woogie, nice name, and he actually pushed him, and he was with a couple of his gangsters, and you would think that something would happen to Teddy Roll. Nothing happened, and this happened several times. He just wouldn't go away, but the outfit just couldn't figure out what to do with him, because they never had an adversary like him before.
And what do you attribute that to? The do you think that they feared his power, or do you think that they more feared the power of the community because of their respect and their love for him and what he was bringing to the community?
Before Mike, I'll just say, that's a good question, and I never really, in my research, I never really was able to figure out why. The only thing I could figure was that, yeah, he was an African American who didn't act like an African American at the time. he was not afraid of white organized crime. And so anything he did was perplexing to them. They didn't know how to react to him. And Mike, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. Because I said, you know, again, quote Chuck Giancana, you know, he often talked about how Sam was talking about, like, he said Sam has like some sort of a buddy and respect for Rogue, and said no one's ever stood up to him like that before. And said Rogue, he employed a small army of bodyguards, which were off-duty police officers. And it was just, I think it was just more so of a thing that he caught the mob. You know, I guess, you know how sometimes they say if you're a hunter, you know, if the lion turns on a hunter, now the hunter is being hunted, they don't know exactly what to do in that situation. I think it was kind of like that. I was like, wow, here's this guy. Because, you know, in all the confrontation between Roe and the mob, you know, it even resulted in the death of Giancana's best friend, fell against the Fat Lenny Caifano, where Roe, well, either Roe or his bodyguard, you know, killed Fat Lenny when it was attempted to kidnap Roe the same way they did Jones. But this time, the mob was going to kidnap him for the ransom and kill him after the ransom was paid, but the tables got turned on them. So they just didn't really know what to do. And they might have, you know, feared community reaction because Roe was, you know, really was well-loved in the community. You know, so just one of those things that's open to speculation. But that was, you know, a good question to ponder.
Fat Lenny Caifano was a soldier in the outfit, Teddy really stepped over the line when he killed him. So the mob really had to act. Of course, there's also, you know, it's kind of hazy, but the question of Teddy Roe's health too, and maybe Mike can explain about that.
Now after Roe was killed, you know, his wife, you know, just did an interview with Time Magazine, and she said that, you know, Roe had been to the doctor weeks before and had only been given like a couple of months to live. And people, you know, when I, like I said, I do my research, people say that, you know, after that diagnosis, you know, he sent his bodyguards home and just kind of, you know, waited for it to happen. Now, some people dispute that, but it is kind of, because that night, September 4th, there were no bodyguards present, and he was murdered like about 10 o'clock at night after he had went to his car to retrieve something. So that's kind of like, you know, why, if you know the mob is at you, why are you going out at night? No bodyguards, so it's a plausible story, you know, but, you know, like most killings, there's several interpretations of what really happened, and you know, no one's really going, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, but Mike, course, that's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, and of course, this added to the legend, you know, and Mike could talk about his reputation today in the black community. He's still, you see, he's a living legend in the black community because of how he handled the outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's stay on his health for just a moment. You know, as you were speaking, Mike, I can picture this in my head, and it makes absolute sense. I mean, why not? You know, why not go out with a bang rather than a sick whimper in your bed? If I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory and honor. You know, I'm going to show these SOBs, you know, we're just as good as them. We're just as organized. You know, we can take you over should we choose. You know,
exactly.
You know, cancer, you know, I don't say this disparagingly, but having cancer or a terminal disease sometimes gives you a case of the brass cojones,
right?
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what have I got to lose? What's the worst you have to offer?
We really, really don't know why on that. I mean, he could have just realized that the fight was up. That's another possible reason, you know, where he just said the fight was up and I'm just going to go out and, you know, check out, and he got rid of his bodyguards and all that. So we really don't know what really happened, because there's a lot of good explanations for what, but it doesn't diminish Teddy Roe's courage and his unbelievable story, you know, in terms of how he dealt with the outfit, which is, you know, at the time, probably the most powerful criminal organization in America.
Mm-hmm.
So now, maybe explain now, what was the effect of Roe on not only the community, but Chicago, even the states? And why was he called Robin Hood?
Well, so he was called the Robin Hood because, similar to like Robin Hood, you know, he gave to the poor. And it wasn't and it was genuine. It wasn't like something for publicity or trying to make himself look good, like a lot of gangsters try to do, establish soup kitchen and stuff, and say, hey, I'm not a bad guy. You know, it was legitimate. You know, he put people, and not just him, a lot of the positive things, they gave scholarships to people, you know, trying to go to college, you know, people who couldn't pay their rent, they were knowing sometimes, you know, pay people's rent, because they understood that, hey, listen, we're segregated. You know, we were at the bottom of society. They knew, look, we're making money off the community, so we're going to give money back to the community. And that was just like a theme throughout policy, whether it was in Chicago, whether it was in New York. I remember watching the program over there, Ruby Dee on, and she was saying, I talked about how exciting Harlem was before the white gangsters took over. She was saying there was always this house on the corner that you needed anything you could go to. You know, if you needed aid, you just needed, you know, just a few dollars to help you buy until you got paid. There's always this house you can go to. And that was similar with Roe, the way, like I said, he took on the, you know, the invading gangsters. You know, he gave back to his community, and people looked up to him for that. Because when he, at his funeral, you know, an estimated 20,000 people showed up for his funeral. And after his death, you know, people, there's one particular Reverend Cobb, he wasn't necessarily a fan of policy, but he did organize a lot of people in the community to stay away from the white wheels. You know, any wheel that was known to be associated with the outfit, they were boycotted. And I'm not sure how long that lasted, but that was just that did occur after his death. That's just how beloved he was in the community.
Right. I think Teddy Roosevelt never forgot where he came from. He came from a very humble beginning, and he did a lot of things with that in mind. You know, because, you know, you look at Al Capone. Al Capone's famous for the soup kitchens that he set up during the Depression in Chicago. But it was all show. And, you know, other gangsters, you know, have done the same thing. And mainly it's just part of their PR effort to try to stay in good with the community. But I think it was genuine on Teddy Roe's part. There were stories that, you know, never made, you know, news, like, you know, helping, you know, somebody. For example, there's a famous story where an elderly woman was not paid the money she made that she won on the policy wheel, and he went to the guy, the policy guy that was supposed to pay her, and said, look, you're going to pay this woman her money, or it's not going to be a good situation for you.
Exactly. Yeah, because that just defeats faith in the whole system, and that could cost you business.
Yeah, exactly. So, but he's just one of those remarkable characters that not many people know about that pop up in organized crime, you know. And I've done, you know, Frank Matthews, for example, the guy that disappeared, famous gangster. Ike Atkinson is another one. But this guy, Teddy Roe, ranks right up there with those characters in terms of his story and in terms of his character.
What kind of personal life did he have, being so involved with this kind of a lifestyle? Did this affect his personal life? Was he able to get married, have kids, do the normal things like that? Or maybe explain a little bit about that.
Go ahead,
Mike. Yeah, that's interesting. There's not a lot, unfortunately, there's not a lot known about his personal life. He was married to Carrie Givens. That was his wife. And interestingly enough, interesting story about her. After Ted's death, she took up with another policy king, Jim Knight, I believe it was, and they're actually, and she's buried with him as opposed to be buried next to Roe. I mean, all of them are buried in Lincoln Cemetery in Blue Island, but she took up with him after her death, after Ted's death. You know, as far as, you know, other things about his personal life, I mean, he lived a nice home on 52nd and Michigan, you know, right where he was murdered at. And as far as children, I don't know if he had any children. I mean, I was able to check now some descendants of Roe, and they've never mentioned any direct children of him. But as far as I know. And like I said, he was, other things, I mean, he did, you know, he was known to frequent the club circuit, you know, go to crap games that were big on the south side of Chicago. So he did most of the regular stuff. But it's just not like a lot of information around, unfortunately. You know, that paints a more broad picture of his life, though. And that was one of the things that prompted me to get into this research. I was like, wow, I can go to the library or do an internet search and have more information than I ever wanted to know about Capone, about Giancana, you know, about Luciano. But these guys, I mean, it's like I have to dig through volumes of old magazines and just.
That's right, and I've done research on several black gangsters, and that's the problem, is trying to find, you know, this personal information. You know, it's buried in history. There isn't a record of it. And, of course, being gangsters, too, that's another, you know, impediment
right.
To doing research, because, you know, gangsters don't keep records on that. So, you know, and unless there's a trial or something, if you have a trial, then you could dig into the trial, because there's a lot of witnesses and all that sort of stuff, so a lot of details come out. But if you don't have that, it's very difficult to try to piece together the background of a lot of these characters, and Teddy Rose and
right.
That.
And that was one of the things that made me so appreciative of Ron, because I was like, you know, a lot of the, you know, of course, you know, back in those days of segregation, so a lot of the mainstream media, the white press or media establishments weren't going to keep a lot of, you know, books or anything about African Americans. But I was always so upset that none of the African Americans did it themselves. So that's why I came across Ron right now, all these books. I'm like, wow, he's this white guy right now, all these books about stuff that, you know, that people like, you know, generations later like me want to know about. You know, he's writing about it, where people who lived through this era never bothered to write about it. So that was like one of the other things that really prompted me to call him and just say, hey, man, thanks for writing this type of stuff. You don't know how much this type of stuff means to people of my generation, because now I'm like 50 years after Roe, and so I talk to the old people and stuff like that who lived through the era, the few that I left, and they, like I said, speak with such admiration about him. But I'm like, why did anybody never bother to write this stuff down? You know what I mean? So it's, you know, it's kind of, so my research is just really frustrating, because it was just so hard to do.
Yeah.
And you see why it's so important when you see the impact of policy, you know, on the African American community. And there hasn't been much written about that. It really hasn't. There's been a couple of books, but they're not really, I don't think, really cover the story of how policy historically has impacted on African American history, and it's been a really big impact.
Well, it's not so unusual, though, not to write it down, because that could be seen as evidence for the police in a RICO case.
Yeah.
But through their admiration, though, is how they kept his legend alive, is through oral traditions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. And he's gonna live on.
Yeah.
And we did our little part to keep the story alive, but it's an important part of the African American history in Chicago.
And Mike, you're in Chicago now, aren't you?
Yes.
How do you think that has influenced life today in Chicago?
Well, you know, it influenced it in a number of ways. I mean, but some of it's been negative. I mean, when the policy was finally, well, first of all, when the mob kind of muscled in, it took away a lot of jobs, because they said, hey, would cut the salaries, you know, where people were making as far as like when the African American owner owned his wheel, you know, they would make tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But when the mob moved in, they were regulated to make the salaries, most of them. And like I said, they was trying to cut costs, they would lay off workers and stuff like that. And even some places led to people staging boycotts, because they're like, you know, you're cutting workers, you know, people depend on this. And then when the final death knell to the policy business, when the real crooks came and took over, which was the state in 1974, the state lottery, that just was the deathbed. I mean, you thought the mob was crooks, you know, the Illinois lottery, oh my God. You had to pay for a dollar, and the money's supposed to go to education, but you go through any school in the African American community, you see it, the money's not evenly distributed, so. So that left a big vacuum. I mean, because, like I said, the policy king, whereas in mainstream society in that era, you can go to the bank for a loan. An African-American, 9 out of 10 times, couldn't go to a bank for a loan, so they had to go to a policy king to start a business or to start whatever venture. They wanted to start a newspaper or anything like that. When I was doing my research, almost any established, I won't say almost any, but a good majority of any type of established thing in the African American community, there was a policy king at the end of that line. I mean, Joe Louis's manager, the famous boxer, his manager was a big-time policy king. He was the owner of a Negro League baseball team. I mean, just a lot of the insurance companies, when they, like the, some of the first African-American insurance companies, you know, they got their financing from policy guys. So when that pipe, so it was like the pipeline to the black community. So when that pipeline was plugged up, it just left a big vacuum, and which kind of street gangs kind of stepped up and filled that vacuum, which has been a major detriment, you know, on the community.
Right.
Yeah, so that's great.
What Mike is saying is ending had a deleterious effect on the black community in Chicago.
Yeah.
As elsewhere, as Pittsburgh, New York, some of the other big
Philadelphia, cities, New York, all over.
Yeah.
And Chicago now is known as quite a shooting and violent city, and it has been for a few years now. Do you attribute a lot of the gangster life to it, like the mobs?
Well, the gangs, I'll just say before you stop, he knows more about this, but the gangs are a very important part of the story.
Right.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, because go ahead.
Well, let me add this in before you answer. I agree to an extent, but it appears to me in my research and listening to you guys talk that the gangs of old had a certain respect for each other, and they had respect within their community. Respect, not fear. You know, there's two types of morale. There's positive morale and there's negative morale. You can get people to do what you want either one of those ways. But with Mr. Rowe, it seemed like he had the respect and he had the love of the people. Now it's the damned OK Corral. You know, let's just shoot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty much a good estimation of it. Those guys really didn't sit in the policy business. Violence was, you know, like a last resort and often really resorted to. Whereas today, instead, it's just out-and-out gangsterism, you know. People getting shot, you know, that's how they get only respect by. The bigger shooter you're known as, the more respect you get. And, you know, and just rewinding back a little bit, I do want to add, like around 19, you know, like right before the state line was established, you know, as the emergence of the street gangs began to emerge in Chicago in the early 60s, you know, throughout the 70s, they did begin to take back some of what the mob took out of the black community. For example, Chicago Tribune did an article in 1971 called Doing a Number on the Mob, where they talk about the mob having to pay big sums of cash to these street gangs to stop robbing their policy establishments. Because, you know, during this era, you know, the civil rights movement and the black power movement was starting to usher in. And even further down, the street gangs, they're like, you know, why are we taking all the risk? And this is our neighborhood. Why are we letting these white guys just push us around? So they began, like I said, robbing another establishment. And then with the emergence of drugs, that really emboldened street gangs to the point that that's when the mob began to get really pushed out of Southside Chicago. And there's this one well-documented story about a particular black gangster named Jeff Ford, the leader of the Black Keystone Nation. And, you know, he had, you know, as he began to gain power, he had started, you know, selling drugs. And, of course, in Chicago, any type of illegal operation, you're supposed to pay up the chain, which is to the outfit. You know, you're supposed to pay a street tax. And they had warned Jeff Ford, you know, you're supposed to pay us, but he kept ignoring the warnings. And finally, he agreed to come to a sit-down with them. And after the sit-down, two members of the mob were found dead. And later, the next day, the restaurant where the sit-down took place was burnt to the ground, and a message was sent to the outfit, get a South Side of Chicago or stay out. And said, by this time, the Black Keystones numbered conservatively about 5,000 members, and the outfit at best had 300 to 400 members, which were middle-aged old guys, so they had no real choice but to, you know, take a step back, you know.
Drugs was the game changer.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it made the gangs really powerful, and they're also violent because of the money involved, and there's so many players in the communities. You know, and it was a different generation. Mm-hmm. I mean, these Mike said, you know, the Black Power movement was big. They weren't going to take any crap from the white mob, like earlier generations of policy kings did, you know, with the white mob. Mm-hmm. And it was just a whole new different era, and they had more power. It was a numbers game, like Mike said, you know, 5,000, 400 or so. And the white mob did the discretion the better part of valor and decided to, you know, back off.
Hmm. Wow. What a great, great story. Excellent book. Recommend it. We have it posted on our website. And it is a Kindle book only.
And right, at this point, right. We're going to come up with other venues.
Yeah, it's always good. Right. The name of the book, Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy King. And our guests have been the authors. We had Michael Rowe and Ron Chapsik. Thank you very much for being on the show.
May I add one thing?
You're
going to be on my show. You're going to be on my show on September 27th.
Yes.
Yes, on Crime Beat. So please tune in. We'll have Alan talk about one of his great books. And we hope you can tune in.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.